Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, the channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Seb Larson, and I'm here today with Dr. Sarah Miller Davenport to discuss her book, Gateway State, Hawaii and the Cultural Transformation of American Empire. Dr. Miller Davenport looks at different ways Hawaii has been used in American imperial discourses.
Dr. Miller Davenport, welcome to the New Books Network. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to this project.
Well, I was doing my PhD at the University of Chicago, where at least at the time, we could do whatever we wanted once we started. And so I actually had no idea what I wanted to do my dissertation on when I began my PhD. And Mark Bradley, who ended up becoming my advisor, joined the department, I think it was a year or two after I started. And so I never actually took any classes with him, but I did my orals with him and I did a field on US and the world. And during the course of my studying for my orals, I realized, you know, there wasn't actually very much written on Hawaii. And the stuff that was written on Hawaii seemed quite disconnected from the larger scholarship on American empire. And there was very little written on statehood. Now, that's not necessarily a great reason to write a dissertation, you know, to choose a topic. Sometimes things are not written about because they're not interesting. But I had a hunch that Hawaii statehood would be interesting, and started, you know, did some preliminary research, went to the archives in Honolulu at the University of Hawaii and the state archives. Found some good stuff suggesting that, you know, Hawaii had a lot to say about, you know, America's role in decolonization, America's role in Asia during the Cold War, a lot to say about, you know, domestic racial formation. And that's kind of how I began this project. It wasn't something that I had necessarily been interested in, you know, long term. It was something I kind of came to in the middle of graduate school.
So how much of it's taken from the structure of your dissertation versus how much is new in this published book?
I would say the structure remained quite similar. I combined a couple of chapters into one and I added two new chapters, but the chapters as is in the book are quite similar to how I was conceptualizing the chapters in the dissertation.
Fabulous. You mentioned, obviously, you went to University of Honolulu and did research there, but I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about other archival sources you used for this project.
So I used a lot of sources from the National Archives, so a number of State Department records, particularly the records of the Peace Corps. I would say that my main repositories were at the University of Hawaii, the State Archives of Hawaii, and the National Archives. I also, you know, I think my first archival trip was to the Eisenhower Library, where I got a travel grant. That was my first travel grant. And I didn't find that much there. Which surprised me. I thought, you know, Eisenhower was president when Hawaii became a state. Why, you know, he should be more interested in it than turned out he was. I think partly because, you know, he fully supported Hawaii statehood, so it wasn't really a problem for him. At the same time, it wasn't necessarily something that he was deeply committed to, and the problem with Hawaii statehood. And the reason it took so long to get past those problems were in Congress. The obstacles to Hawaii statehood were in Congress. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I went to a number of different collections, most of which I ended up finding, you know, just a couple of folders that were relevant. At the Library of Congress, it was, you know, the Michener papers were helpful. I mean, they formed a fairly large part of the second chapter. The John Rooney collection, he was very... he was a congressman from New York at Brooklyn College, and he was a part of the group in Congress that supported the East-West Center. So I found some East-West Center stuff there. But yeah, I mean, a bit. You end up going to quite random places, especially as the project kind of moves along, because you know the places where you think you might find something, you might not actually find anything, and then you realize, like, you know, this somewhat random person happens to have a number of papers relevant to your project.
So, in brief, what would you describe as the argument of Gateway State?
So, I argue in the book that Hawaii statehood represents an attempt by the United States to resolve Hawaii's status as a non-self-governing territory in the era of decolonization. And it does so not on the basis of the reasons for statehood and the claims made in favor of Hawaii statehood are less on the basis of Hawaii's sameness to the rest of the United States, which is traditionally how various territories have become states, right? They're social and governmental structures are in line with other American states, right? And, you know, the process generally in U.S. history has been fairly straightforward in terms of turning territories into states. In the case of Hawaii statehood, it had met the constitutional criteria for statehood, you know, well before the Second World War, but statehood had been denied on the basis of the fact that Hawaii had a majority Asian population. By 1959, the Asian population in Hawaii was the main reason given in favor of statehood, right? Not only would this be a symbol to Asia and the rest of the decolonizing world that America practiced what it preached on the issue of self-government, right? But that it was committed to racial egalitarianism as well. After statehood, those particular ideas and tropes surrounding Hawaii and its multiracial majority Asian population are then institutionalized in all kinds of ways. Hawaii is turned into a bridge to Asia, which is one of the arguments, again, given for statehood. Hawaii can serve as our bridge to Asia. And so you have a number of institutions established in Hawaii, the East-West Center, the Peace Corps Training Center, that are used to help to bring Asia and the United States closer together culturally. At the same time, that has all kinds of sort of broader cultural resonances in the United States. And so various ordinary Americans are also able to participate in Hawaii, in this kind of using Hawaii as a bridge to Asia, so specifically through the tourism industry, as well as through Hawaii food and fashion. By the end of my book, I talk about the ways in which the narrative around Hawaii statehood within Hawaii itself had been was being challenged in all kinds of ways. You know, particularly at the University of Hawaii, where which had been a kind of key institution in establishing Hawaii as bridge to Asia.
And that actually leads us very nicely into the subject of your first chapter, which is really about the campaign for statehood and the various discourses around which in that unfolded. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So the campaign for statehood, goes back originally to the Sugar Act of 1934. So until then, you know, Hawaii had been ruled by a minority white elite who had been very happy to maintain, you know, for Hawaii to maintain its territorial status. But the U.S. government imposes quotas on the amount of sugar that can be imported or exported from Hawaii to the United States in 1934. And sugar, of course, is the backbone of Hawaii's economy. So it's at this point that you have elites in Hawaii who start agitating for statehood, right? Because the quotas are imposed, the U.S. is able to impose these quotas on Hawaii because it's a territory and not a state. But the campaign in the 1930s doesn't really go anywhere. You have a congressional delegation that comes to Hawaii, and they conclude that essentially, you know, the Japanese population in Hawaii can't be trusted. But very shortly after the Second World War, and I think this in part speaks to the very, very rapid transformation in American attitudes toward Japan after the Second World War, you have a renewed statehood campaign. And this one has, you know, is much more organized than the one in the 1930s, has more institutional support in Hawaii, has more congressional support in the rest of the United States. You know, originally, the argument for statehood was made on the basis of its legal right to statehood, right? Again, there are very kind of minimal requirements to turn territories into states. Hawaii met those requirements. It was only fair that it become a state. The main opposition to Hawaii statehood was in the segregationist South, and both, you know, for reasons of, you know, kind of pure racism, right? Because Hawaii is majority non-white, right? They can never, you know, Hawaii can't ever be, you know, truly American. But also because of their assumption that two senators from Hawaii would vote for civil rights. So the campaign for statehood gets dragged out over 13 years. So it begins the first post World War II legislation is introduced in 1946, and it's not until 1959 that statehood is successful. And again, sort of over the course of those 13 years, you see a number of things. You see the discourse around statehood changing from kind of Hawaii's legal right to statehood to the ways in which Hawaii as a state would benefit U.S. foreign policy. You also see in that same period, right, more broadly, a kind of pivot toward Asia in U.S. foreign policy, right, which feeds into the idea, right, that Hawaii as a state will advance American foreign policy in Asia.
And then in your second chapter, it begins with this sort of fascinating image of Dr. Martin Luther King and a number of other marchers in Selma all wearing leis. And there's this interesting connection that emerges between Hawaii and the civil rights movement in the mainland. Tell us a little bit about that and what it tells about broader discourses in race in Hawaiian society.
So it's not a direct connection between statehood and the civil rights movement, although they are very much indirectly connected, as I attempt to show in that chapter. Obviously coming, you know, the links that I'm making here are obviously very much informed by Mary Judziak's work on Cold War civil rights, right, and the ways in which both members of the U.S. government and civil rights activists, you know, argued for civil rights for African Americans on the basis of the fact that, you know, that this was bad for America's global image, right, and the Soviets were using in their own propaganda, targeting the decolonizing nations of Asia and Africa, they were pointing to American hypocrisy, to claim that it was a beacon for democracy, right? And the fact that they have basically a racial apartheid state at home. Arguments for Hawaii statehood are quite similar. There's not a ton of evidence that the Soviets were all that interested in Hawaii specifically, right? But the arguments made in Congress and by other supporters of Hawaii statehood are made on the basis of, you know, this will improve our image in the third world, right? This will counteract Soviet claims of American racism. And so these, you know, civil rights and Hawaii statehood, you know, are kind of happening in the same moment. And, you know, are also, you know, I think the other thing that comes out in that chapter and that comes out in some of the debates around statehood and in some of the discussions outside of Congress around statehood are about the ways in which Hawaii can serve as a kind of racial model for the rest of the United States, right? And that's something that Martin Luther King talks about when he comes to Hawaii. And something that, you know, in the Selma March in 1965, right, that the Hawaii delegation makes that claim as well, right? Hawaii proves that integration works, right? So that's the other way in which Hawaii and Hawaii statehood are kind of being sort of inserted into the debates around African-American civil rights, right? That this is both something, you know, similar to the issue of segregation, right? The lack of statehood for Hawaii looks bad to the rest of the world, right? But there's also this kind of interesting way in which Hawaii is transformed into a kind of racial utopia, right? That, you know, quote unquote, proves integration works, right? And as a kind of land of racial amity that can serve as a model for other Americans. And you have a number of people in the Black press as well, right, who are making these claims, right, and kind of painting Hawaii as this kind of racial paradise.
And then within Hawaii, how does race actually play out? Because there's, of course, a divergence here between rhetoric and reality.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Hawaii, it doesn't, you know, this is something I would say I struggled with in the book, right? How much, you know, part of it is like, well, how much does it actually matter, right? In terms of, you know, what is going on in Hawaii? How does that actually inform the kind of image of Hawaii, right? How much of this is a reality? How much of it isn't? You know, and of course, I think it's a little of both, right? You know, Hawaii doesn't have any miscegenation laws, right? So you do have very, very high rates of intermarriage in Hawaii, right? And that's something that brings all of these like Chicago school sociologists out to Hawaii to study intermarriage, right? And so that's, so you do have this kind of demographic reality, right? That's then used as a way to kind of paint Hawaii as this sort of racial paradise. But of course, you know, you also have a lot of, you know, kind of informal discrimination, right? And the plantation system, you know, as it was conceived and practiced by the white elite in Hawaii, right? They had divided laborers on the basis of their ethnicity, right? So, and it's not really until the 1930s that you have, you know, kind of organized labor movement in Hawaii where workers are able to overcome these racial barriers that had been established by the plantation owners. And so you do have, you know, you do still have division, right, within Hawaii, within the different ethnic groups in Hawaii. You still have, you know, whites are still, you know, the kind of elite class in Hawaii, and are able to, for instance, in the case of James Michener, right, keep certain neighborhoods white, right, through the same kinds of informal mechanisms of segregation that you see in the rest of the United States, right? So it is not this kind of perfect racial utopia, right? But I also think, you know, those ideas of Hawaii as racial paradise aren't, you know, they're not coming from nowhere.
So then in your third chapter, you start to delve into this, deeply into this idea of Hawaii as gateway to Asia and Hawaii as a sort of diplomatic bridge into Asia. And how is that playing out in the state?
So after statehood, right, you have, you know, or even before statehood is secured, you have various initiatives, you know, that are either kind of homegrown in Hawaii, right, or kind of, you know, supported by members of Congress, right, or supported by the State Department to use Hawaii, particularly as a place for educational exchange, and not just and both educational exchange in itself in Hawaii at the University of Hawaii, to bring students from Asia to Hawaii to study at the University of Hawaii, but also Hawaii is what's called a conditioning center for students coming from Asia to the United States who are going, you know, to some mainland university, right? But they come to Hawaii for a few weeks before they go to the mainland, right? As a kind of introduction to the United States, right? But without some of the kind of as a way to kind of prepare Asian students for the U.S. in a place that will be, you know, friendlier to them, kind of racially and culturally, before they have to go to, say, you know, the University of Nebraska or whatever, where there are very few Asians. So that's happening already before statehood. You also have an institution called the Institute for Pacific Relations, right, which, you know, promotes sort of, you know, intellectual exchange conferences, that kind of thing, between Americans and Asians, right? And that's an interwar institution. And then after statehood, you have, you know, a much more concerted effort, much of it led by Lyndon Johnson, to use Hawaii, right, as a kind of, as, you know, to expand Hawaii's role as a bridge to Asia. And so you have two, I talk about two kind of main institutions that represent that. So one is the East-West Center, which is founded as a kind of graduate school at the University of Hawaii. It's now no longer affiliated with the University of Hawaii, although it's on their campus. But it was originally a graduate school within the University of Hawaii to bring mostly Asian students to Hawaii to study, you know, a whole range of subjects, although the vast majority of them are kind of, you know, various technical, scientific, you know, kind of agriculture-related topics, although it's also supposed to be a place for mutual understanding. So you have a lot of American students who are getting their graduate degrees at the East-West Center as well. And it's supposed to be a place, it's conceived of as a place for cultural mixing, right, between American students and Asian students. And then you also have the founding of this Peace Corps Training Center on the Big Island in Hilo, which is the main city on the Big Island. And that, throughout the 1960s, that's the largest Peace Corps training center in the United States. After the 1960s, the Peace Corps moves to in-country training. But while it's still doing volunteer training in the United States, Hawaii is the largest training center and kind of the main conduit for American volunteers going to Asia. And that, again, you know, Hawaii is used as a place that's kind of, you know, a mix between the United States and Asia, right? A kind of mix of cultures and a place where, you know, Asians can encounter Americans while still, you know, in a sort of relatively familiar kind of Asian-inflected environment. And then for Americans who are training the Peace Corps, a place, again, you know, that's kind of, you know, Asian, culturally inflected Asian place or Asian inflected society, right, where they can learn about Asia before they actually go there, right? Because Hawaii has, you know, these different Asian immigrant communities that Peace Corps volunteers are expected to interact with. So those are the ways in which Hawaii after statehood you know, is used as institutionalized as a bridge to Asia.
It also seems to play out in some really humorous ways. I was just struck reading that chapter by the idea of basically setting these Peace Corps volunteers down with these agricultural laborers and just sort of expecting them, A, to just sort of jump into it, but B, also that this would somehow teach them about whole other societies as if the whole thing was just completely applicable across the entire globe.
Right. So, yeah, so this is, you know, I also found that hilarious when I saw it in the archives, right? There's this description of, you know, it's like, first we have, it's like, there's this whole description of I think it's like a weekend in the Waipio Valley. So they were sent to this Waipio Valley that's very remote Valley on the Big Island for a few weeks. And it was like, I think on Saturday nights, they had a luau pig. And then like, then the next day they were supposed to, they were taken by bus or something and then just like dropped off near these, you know, like these plantation work, you know, immigrant plantation worker communities. And they were actually supposed to convince someone to like let them stay with them overnight. Which, you know, so, you know, they're just kind of like dropped in these, you know, like kind of Filipino plantation, you know, community, and they're supposed to make friends, right? You know, which is basically what they're supposed to do in the Peace Corps. So it is apt in a way, right? But also, you know, does strike readers now, I think, as somewhat humorous.
So then in your fourth chapter, you pick up on a lot of the threads that carry over from the second chapter, you know, this idea of Hawaii as this sort of multiracial, accommodating, prejudice-free society. And you examine the ways in which tourism in the state starts to commodify that. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think, you know, so a lot of the literature on tourism in Hawaii, I think, you know, focuses on the idea of Hawaii as a kind of Polynesian paradise, which was what I was expecting when I went into this, right? But what I found was actually the idea of Hawaii as a Polynesian paradise never goes away, but you see just as much emphasis, if not more, on the idea of Hawaii as kind of, you know, a place where you can tour the Orient. You know, that's what one of these tourism ads claims, right? You can visit Japan, you can visit Korea, you can visit Micronesia, right? So it's a way for Americans to, you know, see Asia without leaving the United States, and also to experience this, you know, racially harmonious society, right? So so the tourism industry in Hawaii at this time is both kind of commodifying, you know, again, this kind of image of Hawaii as a bridge to Asia or a kind of little Asia in the United States, and also the idea of Hawaii as this kind of mixed multiracial paradise. And of course, tourism very quickly after statehood outpaces it outpaces the plantation industry, it outpaces the military, right, as the main driver of Hawaii's economy, right? So these tourism is incredibly important, right? You know, and incredibly dominant in Hawaii society to this day, right? So, people in Hawaii are also expected to kind of fulfill this idea, right, of Hawaii as a kind of racially harmonious place, right? You know, and to kind of perform that for visitors from the United States.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You described that spirit as aloha spirit, which it struck me reading it. It's sort of initial pitch by this religious figure is almost sort of an inversion of the melting pot. Everybody comes to Hawaii and certain aspects survive, but it all sort of blends together. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and so the aloha spirit, well, it's all over all of the tourism literature, and it's you know I talk about in the chapter, right, this reverend, he's Hawaiian, Reverend Abraham Akaka, who was actually friends with Martin Luther King, and I tried desperately to see if I could get into the archives at the Martin Luther King Library. I was unsuccessful to see if they had any correspondence, but in any case, he talks about it's in like the United Airlines magazine, so it probably started off as a sermon, right? But he talks about, you know, the Aloha spirit, right? It begins with the Native Hawaiians, right? Because they have, you know, a kind of welcoming culture, right? And they serve as hosts, right, to these white settlers, right, who come in the 18th century, in the 19th century, right? And then that kind of sets the tone for all of the other migrants who come to Hawaii, right? All these different migrant groups come to Hawaii over the course of the 19th and 20th century, right? And they each, you know, they have their own kind of separate cultures that contribute to this, you know, kind of, you know, the broader culture of Hawaii, right? But it's all kind of enveloped by the Aloha spirit, you know, and the kind of the welcoming atmosphere set by the Native Hawaiians, right? And so, you know, big part of the way in which Hawaii is sold to mainland American tourists in this period, right, is come to Hawaii and experience the Aloha spirit. And of course, this is being done, you know, in the late 60s, right, at a time where, you know, I think a lot of Americans, you know, from, you know, across the political spectrum would say there's probably not a lot of Aloha spirit in the United States, right? So, you know, you don't have too many people in Hawaii kind of making that explicit, but I think it's very implicit in the way they're selling Hawaii, right? Like, things in the U.S. right now are kind of tense racially, right? But you can come to Hawaii and escape that.
Well, and there's also this component of armed forces tourism, which is in the same period the Vietnam War is going on. Suddenly, Hawaii takes on this additional importance. And tell us a little bit about that.
So Hawaii becomes a major center for R&R tourism for military personnel. I mean, in many ways, what was interesting, right, is, you know, the soldiers and officers coming to Hawaii for R&R, they're not coming to Hawaii to experience Asia, right? Like, they've been experiencing Asia. And if they wanted to experience more of Asia, they could have chosen an R&R location in Asia. So their experience is actually very different in multiple ways from the tourists who are coming from the rest of the United States, right? And it's also what's interesting about R&R tourism in Hawaii is it's specifically targeted at Army personnel with wives and girlfriends, right? It's a place where you can, or if personnel who want to see their parents. Right. So it's a place where you come to have a kind of heteronormative family experience, right? Which again is in stark contrast to the R&R experiences in parts of Asia, right? Because there's a certain number of sites where you can go for R&R. And Hawaii is the kind of family friendly site, and very much not sold to military personnel as a place as a kind of bridge to Asia, right? Or it's the bridge to get away from Asia in the context of military R&R. And, you know, particularly because all these the Asian R&R sites, right, are known as a place for sex with Asian women, right? And that's you know, doesn't, it's not as problematic to the Army as one might think, right? I think they see it in some ways, right, as a kind of, you know, a necessary form of relaxation, right? But they're also quite concerned about like the spread of venereal disease and stuff, right? So Hawaii is the kind of wholesome alternative to all of that.
And then in this fifth chapter, and I really enjoyed this one, partly just because there's a tiki bar two blocks from my apartment, so I spend more time there than I should. But this really has to do with ways that Hawaii is sort of commodified and sold, and especially on gender lines. Tell us a little bit about that.
I noticed this while I was researching the tourism chapter, that a lot of, you know, that both in the kind of tourism discourse around Hawaii and in a lot of the kind of larger discourse around Hawaii, a lot of it's being targeted at women, and at, you know, at white women specifically. And you know, Hawaii as a site for liberation, for sexual liberation, right? Kind of through this kind of embrace of a kind of racial liberalism, you know, or a kind of blurring of racial boundaries, right? That's a way to achieve other kinds of individual liberation. And so I thought that sort of fashion in particular is talked about very explicitly that way, right? The kinds of fashion from Hawaii that are being sold to mainland women, right, are talked about as, you know, very colorful, right? You know, and as you know, that color reflects Hawaii's multi-ethnic society, right? And is very comfortable, right? And that those two things are kind of being equated in this period, right? That by wearing Hawaii fashion, you will become like a cooler, you know, more sophisticated, more racially enlightened, more sexually free woman. And then at the same time, you have a lot of, you know, I think the other kind of main way that Americans are consuming Hawaii outside of Hawaii, right, is through food, right? So of course you have this proliferation of tiki bars, right, which of course are not necessarily always branded as Hawaii specifically, right? They're kind of generally Polynesian. But they're also, you know, they are, you know, often a kind of implicit reference to Hawaii, and the food they serve is Asian, right? Which I think also speaks to Hawaii as a center for Asian migration. And most of the cookbooks, you know, that are called Hawaiian cookbooks are actually mostly Asian recipes, right? So one of the things I talk about in this chapter is the ways in which Hawaii again is kind of used for, you know, particularly through food, right, as a kind of way into assimilating Asian culture into mainstream American culture, right, or as a way to embrace Asian culture, right, through Hawaii and through food specifically, through Asian food specifically.
And in a highly packaged kind of way too. There's one part that talks just about sushi and the way that most people will not end up embracing it, but for those who do, it becomes a craze, right? It's sort of presenting it as in an exoticized format while also omitting things like poi, which most Americans, there's no poi craze at any point in mainland U.S. society.
No, well, and that's yeah, Victor Bergeron, who the founder of Trader Vic's, right, which is still, I think they're still around. There was one in Chicago. I know it closed a few years ago, but there was a Trader Vic's in Chicago when I lived there, right. And I think he says, you know, some people who embrace sushi become sushi addicts, right? But it's a very selective use of food that is somehow associated with Hawaii, right? And again, a lot of the food that you see in these quote unquote Hawaii cookbooks is not native Hawaiian. You know, so a lot of it has, say, like pineapples in it, right? And pineapples were introduced to Hawaii, you know, quite recently. You know, pineapples are not native to Hawaii, they're native to South America. So, you know, and so most of the kind of actual, you know, traditional native Hawaiian food doesn't make it into these cookbooks. But I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, that most of the food that's in there is, you know, it's Chinese or Asian or Korean or Filipino, right? That's what kind of makes up the bulk of these cookbooks. And that's, you know, that's a big part of how Hawaii is being sold in this period is, you know, as a multi-ethnic, majority Asian place.
And then in your sixth chapter, you take a really close look at the development of ethnic studies at the University of Hawaii. Tell us a little bit about that.
I use the story of ethnic studies at the University of Hawaii as a way to examine the emergence of opposition within Hawaii to the various narratives around Hawaii as a racial paradise and as a bridge to Asia. So you have students at University of Hawaii who are really inspired by what's going on in California, right, where you had a lot of student activism demanding the establishment of Black studies, Asian American studies, Chicano studies, et cetera, right? And they very quickly join the call for that, right, at their own university. One of the things that's interesting about this is that actually at first the university administration at UH is, you know, very happy to establish ethnic studies, right? In contrast to what happened in California, right? Where it took quite a lot of militant student activism to get these programs established, right? But the university administration at UH kind of, you know, sees this as sort of, you know, the fulfillment of, you know, Hawaii's, you know, the kind of multicultural society in Hawaii, right? And you know, an expression of Hawaii's embrace of ethnic and racial difference. Very quickly, though, tensions emerge, right? So one of the things that ethnic studies courses do, right, is they really take a much more critical approach to the history of Hawaii, right? So they highlight the, you know, racial and economic inequality in Hawaii, the history of white supremacy in Hawaii, the ways in which racial and ethnic inequality, you know, continue up till the present day in Hawaii. In particular, they highlight how you know, the American settlement, annexation of Hawaii affected Native Hawaiians. So, you know, first they take on a much more critical take to the history of Hawaii, right, that stands in contrast to the kind of utopian image of Hawaii that's emerged over, you know, the past, 10, 20 years. And they also demand a kind of much more radical approach to the pedagogy of these courses, right? So they, you know, the proponents of ethnic studies see this as a way to encourage activism outside of the university, right? And in fact, many of these courses include a kind of activism component, right? They also are employing, you know, students as teachers, right? So the university doesn't really like this, right? And you know, they say the program isn't really all that academic, right? It's not serious enough, right? It's too political. And they try to shut it down. And there's quite a lot of protest among students, right, and people outside of the university as well, right, demanding that they not shut it down and make the program permanent, right, because it's established at first on a temporary basis, right? And so the activists ultimately win this battle, although I think to some extent, right, you know, at the expense of, you know, a kind of de-radicalization, right? So, you know, they do have to, and, you know, ultimately have to conform to some of these kind of pedagogical demands of the administration, right? And they can't have students as teachers anymore, right? And they can't kind of include activism as part of the coursework. So I choose to end the book with that, right? I choose to end the book looking at the Constitutional Convention in Hawaii in 1978, which enshrines, you know, sort of new rights for Native Hawaiians, right? And all books have to end somewhere, right? But I chose 1978 as my endpoint, right? Because I kind of see that as, in some ways, the end to this, you know, era in which, you know, Hawaii was celebrated in a kind of unproblematic way as a racial paradise, right? So you have, by the 1970s, right, you have a lot more pushback against that idea, right? And then after 1978, right, into the 1980s, you have the emergence of a Hawaiian sovereignty movement, right, that, you know, not only questions kind of Hawaii's history of colonization, right, and the treatment of Native Hawaiians historically, right, but is saying, you know, in fact, right, statehood didn't solve these problems, right? Statehood was supposed to solve Hawaii's colonial status, right? But sovereignty activists say, in fact, it didn't, right? It only, if anything, right, it only kind of solidified that colonial status. So that's where I end.
Is this book and is this scholarship a critique of multiculturalism?
Yeah, I would say it is. And I'm glad you brought that up because I should have talked about this in my discussion of the argument of the book, because multiculturalism is pretty central to it. So, and, you know, I see Hawaii as really a model for multiculturalism as a place where the ideas around multiculturalism develop and are put into institutional practice. So, you know, most of the scholarship on multiculturalism tends to identify its emergence, right, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, right, where you have racial and ethnic groups who are demanding, you know, or who are challenging the kind of traditional assimilationist paradigm for negotiating difference in American society, right, and saying, you know, we deserve to be able to, you know, celebrate our own individual cultural traditions, right, and to also have those recognized, right, particularly in kind of secondary and higher education. But I really see, I kind of start this this history earlier to the, you know, looking at the 1950s, right, and the debates around Hawaii statehood. So, I mean, of course, you have critics of assimilationism and the melting pot going back to the early 20th century, right, particularly figures like Horace Kallen, right, who challenges the idea of the melting pot, right, and you know, kind of says that cultural ethnic groups should be able to celebrate their particular traditions, right? But I think, you know, it's really in the 1950s, right? And in some ways starting, you know, in these debates around Hawaii statehood that you have kind of mainstream liberals who are really embracing and holding up this idea of celebrating difference and recognizing difference and rejecting assimilationism. And, you know, so by the time, for instance, right, by the time Hawaii becomes a state in 1959, right, the main reason given in favor of Hawaii statehood is not about, you know, Hawaii's Americanness, although, you know, no advocate for Hawaii statehood would deny that, right, but it's really about Hawaii's Asianness, right, and that, you know, this is why Hawaii should become a state, right? Because of its Asian cultural traditions, right? And this will send a message to the decolonizing world, specifically to people in Asia, that we embrace different cultural traditions, right? We're not trying to impose American or Western cultural traditions on them. And that's really, in many ways, a response to what's going on in the decolonizing world, where you have nationalist leaders who are calling not only for an end to colonialism, right, but for an end to Western cultural domination, right? This is something that comes out of the final communique of the Bandung Conference in 1955, right, where they say, right, we need to kind of reassert our national cultures, right? And this is a kind of nation building project, right? A kind of re-embrace of our cultures. So the United States, right, you know, they've espoused this anti-colonial rhetoric, right? They want to win friends in the decolonizing world, right? They're sensitive to the fact, right, that nationalists in the third world, right, are going to reject anything that smacks of colonialism. And so, you know, the solution, or one of the perceived solutions to that, right, is, you know, to kind of train Americans to kind of perform cultural respect, right? So you see that, for instance, in the case of the East-West Center, right? The East-West Center mission is, you know, they say, you know, we reject a bland assimilation of difference in favor of a celebration of diversity for mutual good, right? The Peace Corps promotes cultural sensitivity training for volunteers, right, where the idea being that, you know, once they go to their assigned countries, right, they will be able to communicate with the people there, right, in part by demonstrating that, you know, they're not trying to impose American culture on them, right, and that they respect non-American, non-Western culture. Of course, this is all a bit of a hedge to some extent, right? Because the United States does in fact want to impose certain American norms on the decolonizing world, right? Particularly when it comes to, you know, how they organize their economy, right? So, so an embrace of communism, right, is a difference they're not willing to accept, right? And they're also seeking to, you know, quote unquote, modernize countries in the decolonizing world, right? Which also requires, you know, a certain kind of modern mindset, right? So it's certainly a somewhat limited multiculturalism, you know, as enacted, you know, in practice in American foreign policy. You know, I think it, in a domestic context, right, the emergence of multiculturalist discourse, right, also kind of coincides with, you know, other discussions around sort of how to explain the success or lack of success of different ethnic and racial groups, right? So you also have in the same period, right, the emergence of the model minority theory, which scholars like Ellen Wu have talked about to explain, you know, why Asian Americans have been, you know, so successful, right? And that's, you know, sort of inherently a system of measurement where Asian Americans are held as a model, you know, in contrast to, you know, African Americans, right, in particular, right? In the context of Hawaii, you have something similar going on where people of Japanese descent are quite successful, particularly after statehood, right, and are held up as exemplars of you know, economic and social success, right? Whereas other groups, you know, for example, Native Hawaiians, right, you know, do not benefit really from statehood, right, and end up kind of at the bottom of economic league tables divided by ethnicity, right? So, so in that sense, yeah, I think my book does seek to kind of unpack and critique multiculturalism.
And then, I mean, the other book I was thinking about while I was reading your book was Daniel Immerwahr's recent book, How to Hide an Empire, which I think dovetails really nicely with everything you've done here, including the fact that the U.S. is very savvy in finding ways to maintain an empire while maintaining anti-colonialist rhetoric. So my question is, was the path to statehood and much of what you describe here a way to maintain certain imperialist practices?
I would say so, although I don't necessarily think that, you know, the kind of architects of Hawaii statehood would have seen it that way. But in the sense, you know, I think the concept of a bridge to Asia, right? That bridge, you know, it can carry people across. It can carry ideas, right? It can also carry military tanks, right? So, you know, there are some inherent tensions, I think, between America's, you know, more kind of quote unquote benevolent actions, you know, in Asia in this period and its military interventions in Asia. But at the same time, right, the same people are advocating often for both of those, right? For cultural intervention and for military intervention, right? So Hawaii is seen as a way to kind of maintain American power in Asia. You know, and of course, Hawaii is the staging ground for the Vietnam War, right? So, and the military is fully, you know, the military doesn't seem to care that much about statehood, you know, but they're on board with it as long as they can keep their bases in Hawaii, right? And of course, you know, Hawaii, the defense industry in Hawaii only grows with statehood. So the military is very happy to accept statehood, right? And it's a way to Hawaii, you know, the kind of message that Hawaii statehood it supposedly sends, right? And then the kind of use of Hawaii as this like cultural bridge to Asia, right? I think is also a way to sort of, you know, to both promote American interests in Asia, right? But to also, as also a way to kind of downplay, right? Or distract sometimes from American military action in Asia.
Interesting. I just want to conclude by asking what you're thinking of working on next.
So my next project is takes me in a somewhat different direction. So I'm looking at the reinvention of New York as a global city in the late 20th century. And I realize it sounds very different than the current project. So I'm going, you know, I'm kind of moving east. Or west, I don't even know, whatever. I'm moving to a, you know, very the opposite end of the United States. But you know, I think it's similar, you know, or it draws on some of what I found working on Hawaii, right? Doing a kind of local attempting to do a kind of local, national, and global history, right? So, you know, and you know, Hawaii you know, is conceived of, right, in the time period that I study, right, as a kind of center for global exchange, right? And New York is too, right? You know, and I mean, it has been for a while, right? But it's very self-consciously kind of rebrands itself as, you know, a center for global encounters, right, in the late 20th century. And so I'm interested, you know, so this is a kind of another place where I can hopefully do, you know, some kind of, you know, sort of combine local, national, and global history.
I'll look forward to hearing more about this project as it continues.
Me too.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much.